You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Our topic today is one that's really disturbing, but yet as important as the topic can be, and one that everybody needs to be aware of. And I'm sure it's something that just bothers a lot of people in their own personal lives. We'll talk a little bit about more about that. I'll read a headline on the website, finola.com, during the week. It says, New Orleans Archdiocese's target of child sex trafficking inquiry. Officials say. Now, we've been hearing these kind of things for so long, probably some people are desensitized to it, you know, probably saying, not that again. But this is new information that some of it is really, really disturbing. And I want to talk a little bit more about this later about how people react to this. But with me is the guy who's been on top of this story. I mean, a lot of people have been covering it, but this is, he's really taking the lead now. This is Ramon Vargas. He was for many years with the Times-Picayune and the Advocate. Now he's with the Guardian, which is that paper out of London. And your title is weekend editor for the Guardian.
Yeah, I'm an editor and reporter for the U.S. office of the Guardian.
Yeah, all right. And doing some really important stuff. And actually, with this being in the Guardian, and your stories going to the Guardian, it's really kind of getting these kind of stories are getting more international exposure too. Which I think is a good thing. So Ramon, there's so much to this. Let's start. It seems like the latest stories had to do or send around this priest, Father Hecker, who's a man in his 90s, has a long list of charges of sexual abuse. He's been found guilty and admitted to some things. The state police have been looking into this. They're looking into the records. And it sounds like they're saying, well, man, it can't be that all this is just around one priest. I mean, there's got to be a larger ring involved with that. Is that kind of accurate? And if so, could you kind of take it from there?
Sure. As briefly as possible, right? The Catholic Church in New Orleans reluctantly in 2018 put out a list of clergymen whom it considered to be credibly accused. It was initially less than 60 names. It's now it's grown to encompass nearly 80 names, and on that list for the first time was an acknowledgement that a priest named Lawrence Hecker was the was an abuser. According to the list would. The list, like one thing that stood out about it was that it made it a point not to mention how many allegations were against any one priest. So you could have one, you could have multiple, and it'd be no difference. And as that prompted a lot of people to come forward with new claims against Hecker, and one of them was a person who sued the church for damages, a man named Aaron Aber. Sued the church and Hecker for damages for abuse that he says he suffered in the 1970s, 1960s or 1970s as an altar boy in Gretna under Lawrence Hecker. And that lawsuit led to some discovery that basically established that he had, that the church had history, that the church had a history of knew that Hecker was an abuser back to the, 1960s and continued abusing, throughout much of his career. It's a little convoluted as far as kind of like how this disclosure comes to come out, but eventually thanks to that case, and then the church filed for bankruptcy because the list produced a lot of litigation for damages against it. Ultimately, the church produces a statement that that establishes that Lawrence Hecker admitted to abusing or harassing multiple children in 1999. Okay, and he admits he describes acts from the 60s to the 80s in that statement. The church decided to not really do anything, right? And then and not only that, but that letter also described that in 1988, the Archbishop at the time, Philip Hannon, had basically confronted him about abuse allegations. And so now 1999 is the second intervention point, right? When they know that he's an abuser and they still decide not to do anything about it. In 2002, thanks to the clergy abuse crisis in the Archdiocese of Boston, that led to the resignation of the cardinal there. Thanks to that, basically, he ends up having to retire, right? But the church doesn't like disclose that to the public for another 16 years, right? And so all this time, and the way that they let him retire, he got to collect all these benefits. They would secretly kind of pay off these complaints against him, and this is all contained in like secret church records that are contained either in like the pending bankruptcy case or in the civil lawsuit that was filed against Hecker that I described, which is the Aaron Aber case. But it basically, he lived off of the church's support for decades. And despite the fact that he was an admitted molester, right? And among the support was never really being fully reported to anyone that could file criminal charges against him. And there was a disclosure in 2002 to the police, but it described only one case against Hecker that was out of state, not even in the New Orleans police's jurisdiction. And so nothing happened as a result of it, but that wasn't like that report wasn't made public. So he was just kind of hidden for a while. And so eventually, another person comes forward with a complaint against Lawrence Hecker, takes it to law enforcement. And then law enforcement is able to, investigates that claim, gets some of this evidence, obtains a grand jury indictment against Lawrence Hecker, in September of 2023, charging him with rape, kidnapping, and other crimes. And this is for an attack in a church bell tower in 1975 against a person he met at St. John Vianney High School when he worked there. Obviously, St. John Vianney's not closed, but it was a high school that catered to boys who were interested in joining the priesthood. And through that, and I'm getting to the point, through that, they are able to see that this, Lawrence Hecker is one of several cases that it fit into a much broader pattern involving other clergymen in some instances that the public hasn't been informed about. And so that led to the remarkable development that prompted you to have me on, which is state police obtaining a search warrant that explicitly alleges explicitly states that the Archdiocese of New Orleans is the target of an active child sex trafficking investigation, which is obviously a remarkable point to reach, and I don't think one that anyone could envision happening, even just a year ago, when it wasn't clear if any action would be taken against someone like Lawrence Hecker.
Wasn't there an accusation also from a former student that Hecker had choked him and tried to get him unconscious, and then when he was, to have raped him?
No, that's a good question. So that is the complainant in the pending criminal case against Lawrence Hecker. What he alleged was that that Hecker got him close by telling him, hey, like, let me teach you this wrestling move, and kind of acting like he's like roughhousing with him, and gets him up to like a church bell tower, says he'll teach him there, and then he chokes him out. choked him unconscious and then sodomized him is what the allegation is. The victim in that case describes reporting it immediately to his principal, a priest named I don't think he was a priest at the time, but he later became a priest, but reports it to his principal at the time, Paul Calamari, who is also included in the 2018 credibly accused list. And Calamari didn't report it to anybody, according to the victim in that case. And the only thing that happened was that the church paid the victim some like therapy, some psychiatric therapy. But other than that, didn't report it to anyone else, didn't take any action against Hecker, didn't take any action with respect to the complaint, other than kind of paying to have the victim be treated mentally for what he had gone through. And
did Hecker admit to it?
Hecker has not admitted to it. We some of these revelations obviously came out. I was able to report some of these documents back in June of 2023, before the indictment, and then shortly before the indictment, David Hammer of WWL and I went to Hecker's place and confronted him with that 1999 confession, you know, and asked him, you know, does he stand by it? And he did. I mean, he said it was accurate. He wrote it, basically said it was a different time. Won't do anything like that again, I promise. In the course of that, asked him, you know, word of that allegation against him that he would later be indicted on was out there at that time. And so asked him point blank, have you ever choked anyone out? Have you ever, you know, raped like a child ever? And he said no, but he did admit to, you know, his letter, which describes, did admit that the acts he describes in his letter happened, and, you know, overtly sexual acts with children. And,
he admitted it to the lawyer, his lawyer, that it happened.
No, he had admitted it to the church in 1999 in a statement that he delivered to his church superiors, and he admitted it. And then when we asked him, he's like, yeah, no, I admitted to that because it happened. And just to reiterate, it was a different time back then, but I mean, it was as illegal back then to molest children as it is, you know, as it is now. And just basically was like, look, I assure them it wouldn't happen again. And it's been good enough for the church. And I think, you know, we asked him at the time, I remember, like, do you feel like you deserve to be charged? And he was like, well, I don't want to say, like, I don't think it's for me to decide, but I promise, like, I've behaved myself since I did that. But obviously, you know, that statement, I think some of the reporting before then, ultimately, I mean, a lot of that information made its way into the hands of law enforcement. They took action against him, and now it's led to this broader inquiry, in which they characterize him as a link in a much longer chain.
Wow. That's like one of the worst crimes ever. I mean,
it's no secret, in New Orleans. I mean, I went to Catholic schools my whole life, right? Jesuit High School, Loyola University, New Orleans. You know, Stuart Hall, growing up kind of like growing up being taught that, like, if you lied about anything, right, like you were risking your soul's eternal salvation, like being, if you lied about and just, being dishonest, like kind of risked your admission into heaven, you know? I think that kind of seeing the extent to which the, you know, top Catholic Church officials in New Orleans went to withhold the truth about Lawrence Hecker from becoming public, and the way that it had to be kind of like dragged out of them. I mean, look, there's been some bad stuff all across the country, right? I mean, obviously the USA Gymnastics like abuse scandal was shocking. You know, the Penn State abuse scandal was shocking. Boston's like Catholic Church scandal was shocking, but like the bulk of what happened there, like we know about it, right? There have been criminal charges, there have been prosecutions, there have been like attorneys general report that kind of tell everything. That hasn't happened in Louisiana, and that's why I think that like in New Orleans specifically, and I often argue that like that's why the one here shocks me and really offends me the most, because it involves obviously like this organization that kind of puts itself as like we're this like authority on how you ensure the salvation of your soul, you know, and earn the salvation of your soul. And then I think to see some of the actions and some of the dishonesty that is just reflected in their own records, right? It just stuns me. And especially I think that things have gone on so much longer here because like it hasn't been like the light hasn't fully shined on it. And like the saga here isn't necessarily over where it was in some of the other cases that I mentioned, if that makes sense.
Is it all boys? Are there ever any cases with young girls?
I mean, there are obviously we've reported, you know, we're focusing on Hecker just because of the way that it kind of led to that warrant that we've been describing. Which is really being treated like a subpoena where the church is being given time to gather some records and give it back to state police. State police is assured that they're cooperating. But to get back to your question, no, I mean, you'll see, I mean, some of the I've reported, and I mean, David has reported, David Hammer at WWL has reported on a number of other cases, right, about people who were on the list and you're trying to, you know, that you didn't really know a lot about, or people that a lot, you know, victims and victims advocates said should be on the list but wasn't, and then we were able to report the stories out and then they ended up being placed on the list. You see that no, there were, I mean, there were underage girls who were preyed on, and I think in some sense one of the things you see is that there are some of the offenders are preyed on both, right? Made no distinction, showed no preference to, you know, in some cases, yes, like, and you know, Cleric X is, you know, the known victims are all girls. And, you know, Cleric Y, his known victims are all, you know, boys. But then Cleric Z, there are certainly cases where it's, you know, they would switch back and forth as, depending on the access that they had.
But it's mostly boys as far as the overall. Yeah.
You'll see that the most of the coverage has focused on men who describe being abused when they were boys, but there are some pretty high profile cases involving women. I'm thinking of you know, just for instance, and I reluctantly do this because I never want to leave anyone out or anything, but you know, there's a case involving Brian Heifel, right? That name, that was there was a there that was a teenage girl. You know, we've spoken a lot about Paul Hart, who was ultimately found to not have abused, but that case involved a girl. And then I think it's Lloyd, I want to get the name right, Lloyd LeBourgeois, right? Who you know, his that case is, if you Google it, you'll see that the accuser was a girl. So I just want to be clear too that you're right that the bulk are who speak out are men who describe being abused as boys, but then there's a fair number of high profile cases involving girls.
The affidavits, what we know about them, seem to suggest that several bishops knew about this. What do we know about the roles of the bishops
I'm
in
sorry, if I can just correct, it's not Lloyd LeBourgeois, it's Louis LeBourgeois. The bishops. So that is where the Hecker case is so important and seminal in understanding all of this, because Hecker's case establishes how the last four archbishops were in position to know and did know, right? Like their records show that all of them had been informed either directly by him or in writings from their top aides about his abusive past, right? It goes back to Hannon in 88. Lawrence Hecker describes Hannon coming up to him and saying, like, I'm obviously paraphrasing here, but like, dude, cut it out. Like, you know, just whatever you're doing, stop. But that's it, right? There's no turning him over to the archdiocese, to the, you know, police, district attorney, nothing. Archbishop Schulte, after that, is the one who actually receives the confession, right? Who actually receives the confession. And his decision is to send him to therapy, to a psychiatric facility that diagnoses him with pedophilia and tells him, and in fact suggests that, like, if Lawrence Hecker is allowed to return to work, don't put him anywhere around children. Archbishop Schulte decides to assign him to St. Charles Borromeo in Destrehan, which has a grammar school attached to it, right? Alfred Hughes is the one, is the archbishop. And right, remember, this is where it's important to note that, I mean, Hughes served in the Archdiocese of Boston in the years leading up to the 2002 scandal, like the cover-up scandal in 2002. And the Attorney General report that resulted from that scandal found that he perpetuated a pattern of secrecy and, you know, a lack of transparency that sort of contributed to the whole problem. Lawrence Hecker turns in his resignation to Alfred Hughes when faced with all of the claims of abuse against him that were in at the time. And he and Alfred Hughes accepts the resignation, allows him to retire, basically. But that's it, right? Like, just allows him to retire, lets him collect his full retirement benefits. Yes, like, tells him, hey, like, don't, you know, you can't serve publicly. You can't present yourself as a priest publicly. But beyond that, despite the promises of transparency that 2002 scandal, you know, kind of inspired the bishops to say, to promise to take, didn't, you know, just made the choice to not out him as, like, hey, like, this is the reason why he's stepping down. He's stepping down because he's admitted to abusing multiple children, and even more children have come forward. You know, more people have come forward and accused him of abusing them as children. None of that. Like, he just retired, and nobody really knew why. Archbishop Amend succeeds Hughes, and under him, from in the 10 year and from 2010, during a 10 year period beginning in 2010, the Archdiocese spent more than $300,000 settling litigation, accusing Hecker of abuse, and you know, while he worked for the Archdiocese. And again, most of these cases are going to be in the 60s, 70s, in the 80s. From 2010, right, for 10 years. And I mean, Amen was in office in 2009, right? They're not making those settlements, like, without his knowledge. Like, they're just not. And you see, as it is, I mean, I've reported on memos, right, including one particularly stunning one where the victims assistance coordinator at the time, so this is the liaison between, like, the abuse survivors and the archdiocese, writes directly to Archbishop Heyman, this is the ninth allegation we have against Hecker, okay? But number one, like, it's difficult to know whether that is. There's a good indication, like, it says that's the ninth that they know about, but, like, you know, all indications are that there's more, right? There's all indications, like, you can't really tell, like, who they're referring to. Are they not counting this one? Are they counting this one? Like, it's just difficult to know, but, like, it says this is at least the ninth allegation that we have against him. So you combine that with the settlements that happened during that time, like, it does not wash to say, like, we just didn't know and we just didn't anything. And then ultimately, yes, like, Archbishop Amend. So two more things I'll say on this front. Yes, Archbishop Amend is the one that decides to include Hecker in the 2018, like, disclosure of the credibly accused. But again, like, it was 9 years into office, right? And so, like, it was 9 years into when he took office. And yes, he's the one that put him out there, but it also, the first time that the church likes to point out, like, we reported him back in 2002. We already established that that was a very inaccurate report of what they knew about Hecker at the time when they reported him to the police. And the one thing that they reported him on was something that didn't even happen in their jurisdiction. What we can say is that in it wasn't until the district attorney's office in New Orleans obtained a subpoena and hand it to them. And obviously a subpoena is not like we're asking for this. It's like, give us this or you run the risk of us like prosecuting you for defying the subpoena. It wasn't until they issued him a subpoena that they turned over their full file to authorities on Lawrence Hecker. They do that 3 months after that, 3 months after they turn over those records, a grand jury indicts him on rape and kidnapping charges. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, do you see like when the full reporting like was actually made to the authorities, how quickly they acted because the evidence is just overwhelming. But and the question is, and obviously what we've now learned is that like the evidence is overwhelming against him, right? Which is what led to the quick charges. But you know, the evidence, there's also very compelling evidence to the point that like the investigation didn't stop there, right? Like the investigation is now, can we hold people accountable who knew, you know, who knew about Hecker and didn't properly report him? Can we hold them accountable for those decisions? There is some uncertainty in the case in the sense that, you know, we reported on a psychiatric report exclusively, I believe, David and I at this point, on a psychiatric report that says that a team of psychiatrists has evaluated Hecker and believes that he is not that he has short-term memory problems that make it difficult for him to assist in his own defense. He must be able to assist in his own defense to constitutionally stand trial. So they have recommended that the judge presiding over his case find him incompetent to stand trial, at least for now. And obviously saying that, like, look, it's a condition that he can come back from if he's treated, and we should reevaluate him soon. So there is some uncertainty there because obviously, if the judge adopts that finding and takes that recommendation, that could result in a delay. And a delay, any sort of significant delay, can be decisive when your defendant is 92, like Hecker is. But that said, obviously, you know, I think that what we know about now, regardless of what happens with that criminal case, and it's important to the survivors community to see him be charged, and it's important to the survivors community to see him stand trial or you know, to be convicted eventually. You know, obviously no one knows what's going to happen, but like it's regardless of that, like what we've learned has been very, very illuminating, regardless of how this all culminates.
Another one of the factors I would mention about and this was shocking, the swimming pool at the seminary, that there was a lot of nude swimming at the swimming pool.
Yeah, I mean, obviously some of the most one of the things that jumped off the page of that state police warrant was how it described that search warrant described how victims reported being brought to the Notre Dame Seminary, which trains New Orleans' Catholic priests, you know, and it's right next to the Archdiocese's office. And they would take them there to swim nude in the pool, and this is a direct quote from the warrant: get, quote, sexually assaulted or abused. Another quote: this was discovered to be a common occurrence, and it was reported that other members of the archdiocese were present at the pool at the time. Although not all, many of the alleged sexual abuse cases or incidents occurred on archdiocese property. We also know from reporting that 1999 statement, and all the paperwork that generated, that Hecker at one point had been confronted about taking children to the New Orleans Athletic Club and swimming nude there with them, right? And then at some point that, you know, enough kids sort of describe that and then describe he'd get close and he'd kind of be grabby and you know he'd kind of rub up against you, like rub his parts up against you, and I mean to the point that a New Orleans he describes a New Orleans Police Department officer basically like speaking to the kids, then going to him and saying, "Hey, like maybe don't be so physical with them, you know?" Because the kids had started kind of becoming distant and avoiding him, and he's like, "Hey, like what's going on?" So a police officer gets involved and basically takes this report and tells him, "Hey, like just don't be so grabby with them, and you know, maybe just give them some distance." And he says he did that, and everything was back to normal. So obviously that, but then again, that's at the athletic club. That's not at the seminary. So you're describing, do you see what I mean? Like when it's like kind of part of a broader pattern. another
The
thing.
athletic club, people used to talk about that. I remember people talking about that. That was kind of a common thing that people would go there. You know, I think like Tennessee Williams would go there, and so it's common.
So I looked into that because I did not realize that it was like a place where you at some point where you would just go swim naked, right? And it was like men only. I did not realize that it was like that. And so I looked into that, but I think pretty clearly, like the first thing that everyone arrives on is, and this is kind of like where, like, oh, it was like a certain time. Like you see where like Hecker gets that rhetoric, but it's like it was a different time, but like you weren't supposed to bring children to the club for that, right? It was very clearly like adults, like men that were supposed to be, you know, able to use the facilities. And so yeah, I mean, I looked into that too. If another thing that I can say, the other thing that I think that everyone mentions in the warrant is the this idea that you know, additionally, it was reported that in some instances, gifts were given to abuse victims by the accused molesters with instructions to pass on or give the gift to certain priests at the next school or church, the warrant contended. It was said that the gift was a form of signaling to another priest that the person was a target for sexual abuse. So, yes, like in our reporting, and it hasn't always been used in stories, but in our reporting, multiple people who at the time did not know each other, and or were referring to different priests, right? Not the same one, different priests, that they would give like one like token. So the person receiving it has been abused already, right? By the person, and their abuser is giving them like a token to give to another priest at some other institution that they're going to. They go, the victim goes and follows instructions and gives it to that person, and then that person then abuse them. And the allegation being that like it was like a signal of like this is easy prey, you know.
So
And
if a kid was moving on to another school or changing, that a priest would give him this and say, "Look, here's this gift. When you see Father so and so, give it to him." Or
yeah,
so
or it, and it would be like, and not only, and I don't mean to interrupt you, it's just like it would also be like it wasn't necessarily that they were moving on, but it's like, you know, you play. You know, you go to your neighborhood church, but you go to a Catholic school across the river, right? And so it would be like, hey, like you go to that school, I know a priest there. Give them this. And then what you were about to say.
okay.
Well, and I, yeah, I mean, hey, give them there. And then they would go. And then that was like a signal, like they, without knowing, it's like essentially putting a target on themselves.
When this first started, I guess it's been around for years, but when we first started hearing about this, when it became something that people would talk about, there was a priest named Dino Chanel, and I think that was the first public kind of case on this. And Harry Connick was the district attorney. New Orleans at the time, and Harry Connick was a good old Irish Catholic boy and all that. And I always wondered about Connick, and I think a lot of DAs around the country, once they started facing this thing, were kind of torn about what's the right thing to do. Do you betray the church, or do you stand up for the civic good, or that sort of thing? What do you think that those kind of civil authorities were going through?
Man, that's a good question. I'm not trying to be unfair. You know, obviously someone like Harry Connick, I think I mean, there's no way that I think that some of these, it's very difficult for me that like once you look at the when once you look at the records and once you see like the extent to which people developed reputations and things like that, and like it was all around them, and that they didn't know anything about it, or that it was just a different time, and that you know that they were just more innocent back then. You know, obviously, I think that someone like, I mean, Harry Connick is very Catholic, right? I mean, synonymous with like a lot of different Catholic institutions. You know, the Dino Chanel case. You know, we know. You know, we know how that case ended, right? Which is him being stabbed to death by someone who was 18 and described having a romantic relationship with Chanel, you know, from before. Obviously lends a lot of credence to some of the, you know, someone who's like 18 and has been kind of broken up with by Chanel in Colombia. the South American country, sort of lends credence to what the allegations were about the 80s and 90s, that he kind of had a thing for either, you know, very young, you know, people. It's difficult for me to say because like I there's no way that like this could have flourished, I think, without getting the extreme benefit of the doubt to it, right? All these years, like the church is just sort of like allowed, like, and this is a fact, like the church is sort of allowed to make the call on the credibility of something. And then they're like, if they their policy was like, if look, we're not going to, all right, like let's say we get a, let's say someone comes to us and they're an adult, okay, and if we don't want them to, if like we're not, if they're an adult and they describe abuse to us, like we're gonna leave it to them to go to the authorities, right? You eliminate a huge pool of people, right? Like we know for the most part, like people take decades to come forward. That's not really what the law says, right? Like you're not supposed to be like, oh, well, like if they're adults, like it's their responsibility. Like no, like if you're like a, I think that like when you look at best practices for like reporting crimes that your institution may have, you know, been implicated in, like you're just supposed to like report them. But you know, they would do this whole thing where like they didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to force anybody into maybe like coming out. But then also sometimes they would kind of like settle out of court, and these agreements would have like confidentiality clauses, and that's kind of how far it went, right? What the point that I'm getting at is that that is probably like a concession that a lot of organizations weren't wouldn't be allowed to make, right? And that's something that like I think prior district attorneys would probably need to answer for. You know, obviously like Leon Cannizzaro did prosecute George Brignac, who was also another infamous clergy abuser. When the list came out, like Leon Cannizzaro, Jason Williams was the district attorney whose office obtained an indictment against Hecker. And I think that obviously like that, you know, they made that decision. And then I think that like for a long time, like the church's pattern of kind of like picking and choosing and kind of like being allowed to operate this policy of like we only report to the authorities cases that involve a child coming to us and telling us that they've been abused. When we know that a lot of the times like children don't do that. Children wait until they're adults to come forward and report that. And then again, like the Hecker case shows you, in this case, a child went to his principal. And his principal essentially, and then what happens is that the child is paid off basically through therapy to not talk about it anymore. And that's as far as it went, you know, until he became an adult and then took it to law enforcement himself. But again, so do, that's why the value of the Hecker case. And so that's just a long way to answer that, that I don't, I think that anybody, I don't accept, and this is just me, and this is informed by my reporting, I don't accept this notion about like the 70s and 80s were just a more innocent time, and nobody really understood the concept of pedophilia. Nobody really understood the concept of clergy members like abusing their positions of trust to get close to children to then prey on them. And that's why like you didn't see that, you know, that's why you didn't see those prosecutions back then. You know, obviously they, and that's just, that, I mean, that's what I could say about that.
I'm just wondering if there's more precedent today. You know, someone in Harry Connick's situation today would see what's happened since then, whereas back then they didn't have any guidelines to go by.
Well, I mean, let's like see the Chanel case, right? Like, I mean, I'm gonna read you a story that I wrote when Chanel was killed in Colombia, several years ago. I'm gonna read you just a section right here. So then District Attorney Harry Connick was a parishioner at St. Rita, let the archdiocese hold on to the video recordings that were at the center of the case. For weeks, church officials explained that they were trying to identify and contact any victims involved. And then Connick later concluded that the evidence in the case was not strong enough to prosecute Sunil, right? So initially, like he initially the decision was made that there's not enough evidence here. You know, and at the time, you know, a former sexual partner who said he was underage at the time he had a recorded encounter with Chanel, sued him in Orleans Parish Civil District Court, 1991. Obviously, you remember this. WDSU-TV reporter Richard Angelico aired stories on that case, aired audio clips from the sex tapes as well as video depositions showing Chanel kind of describing everything. All that had to happen before, like, whatever charges against Chanel were brought up against. Correct me if I'm wrong here. I'm desperately trying to, like, just look through this as we talk. But remember, was it – I mean – he was charged with not the acts, right? Like, he was charged with, like, possessing child pornography. And then I think the case turns on the fact that at the time that all this happened, like, you know, the material didn't fit the definition of the offense at the time that it happened, right? And that kind of, like, was the decisive finding in the case. So do you see what I mean? Like, that's not, that doesn't, like, necessarily, like, paint someone who was, like, I mean, that's a lot of evidence in that. I will say I would usually not, I'm not trying to speak ill of the dead at all. And, like, with all due respect, I will, obviously, the former district attorney Connick was very upset at the way that I kind of summarized that case when it came out. I remember that well. But again, like, I stand by it, and I stand by the fact that, like, the way that was handled doesn't really strike me as somebody that was all that eager to take that on. I would like to see if the case was handled the same way, if instead of, you know, a Catholic priest, we're talking about you know, like a sports coach, or, you know, a janitor at a school, or something like that.
Well, in the Penn State situation with Joe Paterno, in his world, he was a bishop, I guess, okay, being the head coach at Penn State. And he was really a very respected coach. And with Jerry Sandusky, the guy who was ultimately implicated, could Joe Paterno have been like a bishop figure in this? And, like, he was more concerned with protecting the institution?
Yeah, and I guess, like, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it's like, you know, Joe Paterno fell, right? Like, I mean, his downfall was that. And I think in many instances, right, like, we've got, all right, now, like, let's carry the metaphor out here, right? Like, you know, we know what we know now. The school on the North Shore still has, you know, Hannah's name. There's still, you know, Archbishop Amond has been in office for, you know, is there's no indication that there's any pressure for anything like what happened to Joe Paterno to happen to him. And then obviously, like, in between, like, Schulte and Hughes, I'm less familiar if there's any, like, facilities named after them, but and obviously they're not in office anymore, but I, in many ways, like, yeah, I mean, obviously, like, Paterno took, you know, turned a blind eye, and I think it's been, you know, obviously, but I think that, like, the difference you see there is, and then, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry Sandusky was imprisoned, right? Like, I mean, he was imprisoned and all that, and I guess that's, like, what I mean. Like, eventually, like, it let me see here. Yeah, so he's imprisoned, right? And I think that in many senses, like, it took them a while to come around and come to it. I think that here, that a lot of the times what we've seen over and over again happen in New Orleans is something like Chanel. He was acquitted on, like, a super technicality, right? Like, George Brignac was, I think, acquitted one time, died under indictment another time, right? Lawrence Hecker is on the verge of getting, you know, a key. Lawrence Hecker is on the key of on the cusp of getting a delay that could be, like, the last chance to ever get him before a jury on the charges against him. And that sort of, like, happens out over and over again, where it just never quite gets to the, it never quite gets the justice that I think that victim advocates and victims themselves want. But that's not to say, I mean, like, in Jefferson Parish, right, you got a deacon, V.M. Wheeler, who pleaded guilty, right? And then his victim got a pretty, not only that, but then his victim got a pretty sizable settlement. I mean, the seven figures. And then and on the North Shore, Pat Watney, Guilty Plea. Wheeler's passed away. Watney, didn't get that long of a prison sentence, but it's rare. I mean, it's been rare. And in some cases, you got Robert Melanson in 1996. He was convicted of child rape, sentenced to life in prison. And then Archbishop Amon becomes aware of some of it and endorses tacitly some of his subordinates, including Wheeler, who I mentioned, trying to get him freed from that life sentence on medical compassion grounds, just to be as briefly as possible, right? So even when like in the rare case that like anything that looks like a form of justice, like there are efforts to sort of like undermine that. So I think in that sense, like that's one of the difference between some of the other cases, including the Paterno one, like excuse me, like the Sandusky Penn State Joe Paterno case, and some of the other ones than what we're seeing here in Louisiana and in New Orleans specifically.
We're talking to Ramon Vargas, who's done a lot of the really breakthrough reporting on the whole Catholic Church sex scandal cases. He's now the an editor for the Guardian newspaper out of London, and the editor and reporter for many years with the Times-Picayune, where he did a lot of the really breakthrough stories. Ramon, just to is there anything that you're aware of going on within the church to try to fix this?
I mean, obviously they would disagree with this, I think. The bankruptcy ostensibly, in their materials, their statements, their literature, was meant to come up, it was like the most equitable way for everyone with pending abuse claims against the church to kind of be made whole financially and allow them to kind of still carry out their mission. The thing is that, like, and I'm being a little harsh here, but again, it's informed. It's not opinion. It's informed by my knowledge of their own documents. What you don't see in those documents, what you don't see in those documents is like when they're outward facing, like when they're said, they talk about walking with victims. They talk about, being compassionate. They talk about, and I'm talking about the Archbishop often, there's statements attributed to him. But when they're like communicating with each other, or when they're like, I'll give you just a little bit of the flavor of what it of what that it says. In 2015, the Archbishop is communicating regarding a $40,000 settlement that a molestation claimant, a person who accused. Someone who is on the credibly accused list 3 years later, okay? And it's sort of like an apologetic thing, but it's like, hey, like, we need to, basically describing that the amount, 40,000, it's not that much, is for, enduring child abuse. That it basically we're limited to that amount because of the church's need to be, quote, a good steward of the funds given to us for us to use in the church's mission. Another one is to another abuse victim. We must. I'm sorry. When referring to the concept of compensation to abuse victims, the Archbishop, it's a statement attributed to him in their own records. We must be careful that there is not a dependency created. I've made a big point about this. I don't think they're crazy about it, but I'm gonna do it here again anyway. This was a text message that came up in the bankruptcy, right? It was produced as part of the bankruptcy. It made reference to a newspaper article about how the archdiocese had continued to pay the retirement benefits of credibly accused priests. I wrote that article, right? Pray for our enemies is what the text message said, right? And a letter to the Vatican after the archdiocese was ordered in bankruptcy court to stop providing benefits to credibly accused priests, right? Amon called the court's ruling unjust and painful. And then another one where he's referring to, a journalist. it was me. Discontinued retirement benefits. It was a story about the discontinued retirement benefits, and then it also made reference to an attorney who represents numerous of the molestation victims. Satan is alive, right? A lot of
You said that about you?
it is a text message, and it is without, and it is, and like, I was assured that I misread it. I was assured that, like, that wasn't it. I am. And to the point, like, and that's what I'm talking about, like that Catholic guilt that you're kind of raised with, right? It's like, man, did I read that wrong? Was I too harsh? But then you go back and see, like, no, it's exactly what it seems like, right?
Yeah, Satan is alive is a pretty strong statement there.
It how do I say this? Like, and even then, like, it's like, even like, I saw it and then I reported it, and then there's a little bit of pushback, and then I'm like, man, like that Catholic guilt, like, damn, man, did I mess it up? Was I being too hard on them? And then you go back and confirm it. No, it's exactly what it seems to be. That's what I'm talking about. Obviously, the conversations are about abusive, like, you're talking about people who prey on children, right? Like, attack, molest children. And the people who are being described as enemies are people like reporting the facts on that, or representing like the victims, right? And so I guess when you ask me, like, are there doing and or is the church doing anything about it? Yeah, I mean, everyone sees that you have to sign the background check, right? But then that's the other thing, is that like Lawrence Hecker passed a background check in 2019, right? Like, you go through the you look at it, and he passed a background check because, he hadn't been arrested at that point. Any number of people that were on the credibly accused list passed the background check because, like, they weren't, they're not in the system, as it were, in the law enforcement system, because they haven't been prosecuted. So I guess that's my answer to that. I mean, I know it's frustrating. I hope I'm not frustrating you, that like I'm kind of like going, but like when you ask me, like, is the church doing something? Like, yes, there's like the background checks. Yes, there's the idea that, like, oh, they're much more aware, that they train people to not be alone with children, and then they train people to not do that. But then Pat Watney admits to abusing a child in the 2010s, and they had inappropriate text messages on the record and things like that. And so I it's a mixed answer, in the sense that, like, there is a lot of talk about how different it changed, and we've been discussing it, but then those types of attitudes, like, we don't want to create a dependency on people. Like, there's just no cottage, this idea that there's like a cottage industry of people going to the church and lying about being molested by priests to make a few thousand dollars. Like, it just isn't it, like, it just, there's no evidence that that's the case. There is a lot of evidence, right? Like, in the bankruptcy, we know that 300 personnel of the archdiocese have been fully named in allegations, right? And they consider, less than 80 of those to be credibly accused. Like, when you do the math, like, what we know about that, when we know that less than 1 in 10 can be shown, cannot be substantiated, and that's different from being proven false, right? Because, like, there's a difference between not being substantiated and being proven to be like an outright lie. Like, right, it is, we know that it is rare for someone to come out and lie. It happens, right? I don't want to sit there that it doesn't. It's happened before, but it is rare. This idea that, like, everyone's just lying and coming out in one thing, like, but the idea that we must not, like, create a dependency, like that type of verbiage, talking about, like, being told to stop financially supporting people that you believe to be child abusers is unjust, right? Painful. Referring to people, like, telling their stories or representing them in court, Satan is alive, using the phrase to describe that, like, it just doesn't describe to me as like meaningful change at this point of the clergy abuse crisis. And that's yes, it's an opinion. Yes, I'm a reporter. Yes, it's an opinion, but that is an informed opinion by spending countless hours of my life, like,
Sure.
reporting this out.
Well, there's so much I want to ask you. We can just go on and on. Let me just say, and we're going to have to wind up, unfortunately. But let me just ask you. You went to Jesuit, right? I mean, you were raised in a Catholic family and a Catholic culture. Is your family from Mexico originally, or where did your family?
Yes, my parents are
Okay.
Mexican.
raised in Catholic culture, raised in New Orleans, a very, very Catholic city, went to Jesuit. And I've got to tell you, I remember one time when all this was first starting off, thinking about what I was hearing, and one time thinking, well, the church really seems to be kind of like falling apart, but at least there are some institutions that are strong. And one thing that I thought to myself is, like, Jesuit. Okay, you know, there's still the Jesuits here, you know, who are a big force and who are an important educator. And then the stuff that's come out of Jesuit over the, you know, the last few years. I guess my question is, what do you think?
I mean, it's difficult, man. I mean, like, look, I had a good time at Jesuit, right? Like, I think that a lot of times I've been asked, like, did something happen to you? Like, did you have a bad time at Jesuit? Like, is this all like that? There must be like some other like secret that's sort of like driving like my dedication to this topic, right? No, I mean, like, I had a good experience at Jesuit. Jesuit taught me a lot. It was painful to be the one to report the way that they paid off victims and didn't disclose that you know, that they had abusers at the campus that who preyed on not only students there but children in the neighborhood. Like, obviously, you know, the reaction among some of my classmates were very supportive and very proud, and then I think that there were some other alumni who felt that I betrayed the institution. It wasn't something that like I wanted to ever be in the position to report. That said, like, I mean, that is the institution that, like, you know, the concept of man for others, they drill that into you, right? The concept of, like, in a dispute between the meek and the powerful, like, you fight with the meek, you know, and you speak truth to power and things like that. And I think that it's probably less fun when those cannons are pointed at the institution, but that's the truth of it, man. I mean, I think that like my approach to some of this was instilled by them, right? I think my approach and my sticking to it was instilled by my teachers, lay and clergy at Jesuit. And so yeah, it's a complicated thing to be in, but I'm there's a healthy number of people who see it my way. Who grew up in the same institutions I did. And I think that the number is growing the longer this goes on.
Well, I think we all have the same conclusion, because I raised this question. People have raised the question, you know, why y'all talk about this? You know, if you want to do something good for the church, you got to let the truth come out, because it's not going to go away. It's going to go away. All right. The truth's got to come out. And in the meanwhile, just think of all the victims you may be preventing, you know, by letting the truth come out. So
yeah, 100%. If this type of conversation happens, and think if this is playing out in the '80s, and you know, and even then, like if it's playing out in the '80s, at the '90s at the latest, think of everything that could have been headed off. I mean, mm-hmm. and I think that a lot of people who even the people that went through the worst of the worst, right? And we understand how complicated and how difficult it is to come forward. And they don't overcome that right away, and then find out that even if one more person went through what they went through because they didn't speak out, like they feel bad about that. And then, but now multiply that across the known body of abusers, right? Which isn't the full set as far as we can tell. I mean, it becomes quickly overwhelming at how much this happened, and it becomes quickly overwhelming how much of it, how long it was covered up. And yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. I promise this is the last question. All right. The movie Spotlight came out a few years ago, won Academy Award for Best Film. And that was about what happened in Boston with the investigation in the newspapers. So it's a story about newspapers and reporting. Did you see the movie? Were you influenced by it?
Yeah, I mean, I said, like, I know I've told you this in private, but I'll say it now. I watched the movie, and this is probably the most uninformed thing I've ever said. When it ended, I looked over at the people that I was watching it with, and I said, "Wow, I'm glad it wasn't that bad in New Orleans." And then I fire hose of the stuff like begins being sprayed at me, beginning with like the first Jesuit case that I reported on. The one of Ricky Windman being abused by Cornelius Carr and a janitor by the name of Pete Modica in 2018. And that was, you know, sometime after that. But before that happened, yeah, my reaction was like, wow, I'm glad it wasn't that bad. And now, all these years later, there's been like some collective moving on, like the job was done after Spotlight, right? And I think that like there has been like some collective like, oh yeah, like that story's been told, and you know, like that's but no, I mean, I think that like in a lot, like New Orleans is just the place that I'm at, and it went on longer, and I think like it was just as ingrained here, if not more so. It took a lot longer to kind of like figure out, and it took a lot longer to kind of get out. So that's why I think, not to like play like the trauma Olympics here at all, but like it, because it's not that, but I mean at a minimum it was just as bad as it was in Boston, but for a long time I think I kind of embodied that reaction of like, man, it wasn't that bad down here. Yeah, there were a few, but there weren't that many. And I think if you go back to the coverage in 2002, like you'll see how like New Orleans has like a smaller share of abusers compared to other dioceses. And that's just not true. Like that turned out to not be true once like you started kind of chipping away at that.
There's a scene in Spotlight where one or maybe two of the reporters go to the home of this elderly priest who's under investigation, and he comes to the door and he starts answering questions. And then while he's talking, his sister comes and takes him away from the door, okay? Years pass, okay? And I don't remember if it's you or David Hammer or both of you, that you were at the door of Hecker, okay? Do you remember that? Was that
yeah,
you?
I mean, it was the two of us. It was in August of 2023.
It was like the same scene. It was like it came together, okay? And then, was a poor man just putting out, and I don't remember if somebody told him to stop it, but it was just a sort of the same sort of thing. It was shocking.
Look, it's impossible. As I'm walking up with David, right, I'm not entirely sure what we're about to walk into, but I knew, like, other people had kind of pulled that move, which was just ring the doorbell and let him start, right? The one thing that we had that no other reporter had was his own confession to abusing all those kids, right, in the years earlier. Walking up, it was impossible not to think about that scene that you're referring to in Spotlight. Two things I remember is that it was blazingly hot, right? It was in one of those days in August where the sun was beating down. It was 100% humidity. It was in the hundreds, heat index and above the hundreds. And I'm like just trying to not pass out. I was wearing a suit. And the other thing being, as I'm walking up, thinking of that scene in Spotlight, I'm like, Jesus Christ, this is like the scene in Spotlight only, you know, 21 years later. Showing like how much longer all of this has gone on here in a way that it didn't in Boston, because it was just uncovered there quicker.
Ramon, since the original stories came out, you've been doing some more investigating, and some of that has been reported since the original stories. What are some of the things you're finding out now?
Yeah, so David Hammer and I today published our report on revealing that we obtained an 8-hour, 8.5-hour deposition that Lawrence Hecker gave under oath in one of the in Aaron Abers' lawsuit against him, and he gave that in December 2020, and it shows in no uncertain terms the extent to which the last four archbishops, in his own words, under oath, the last four archbishops knew about his past and basically shielded him from being exposed. Some of the stuff is really, really shocking. It wasn't a big deal in those days is how he kind of describes, just summarizes why it was that he got the treatment that he did. Like, just, it wasn't a big deal. Like, what I did wasn't a big deal in those days. Another very telling quote, the attorney conducting the deposition, who was Aaron Hebert's attorney, Richard Trahant, asks, hey, like, Didn't you feel fortunate that you weren't like thrown in jail years ago for and he at that time he wasn't in jail, right? But aren't you don't you feel lucky that you've been able to like avoid jail all this time, despite everything that you referred to? And he said, that just wasn't even thought about. Like, oh, I don't think that was even thought about, right? So this idea that like the concept that I don't think that was even thought about at the time. So the concept that like something like that could happen, right? Like at in his prime was just unheard of. And I mean, there's some other things that I would urge you to please go to WWLTV.com or go to theguardian.com and read the full report. But just the thing like when he was flown to a facility to that ultimately diagnosed him as a pedophile, right? He you know they paid for a limousine to take him to the facility that after that he's sent to because he's admitted to molesting all these kids, and they're looking for a confirmation about whether he's a pedophile, right? Another thing is that during a sabbatical in which he's receiving treatment for his diagnosis, the church is paying for him to receive therapeutic massages. He claims that he never took more than one. And then another thing is just that he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights under the Constitution. Obviously, it's the right against self-incrimination, 117 times during the deposition, right? So that's about once every 4 minutes. So it's that is quite a strong indication that he was worried that he would be charged if he answered the questions honestly. Obviously, it's his right? Like you have a right to not incriminate yourself, but then also like if you invoke it that many times, it means that you're quite worried about your potential criminal exposure. And yeah, like sure enough, I think that once some of this stuff got into the hands of law enforcement, he was pretty quickly charged. And again, I continue to go back to the fact that like that is why it is that's why it was so fundamental to keep this stuff from becoming public, and the church acted like it in the way that it handled Hecker's case. So it's the most complete account yet, in the priest's own words under oath, about the way that he was kind of coddled and the way that he was supported. And the other thing that comes clear in the deposition is how much they feared, how much the church feared media exposure, and that he would be that one of the big concerns is, I'm just going to read a direct quote from an archdiocesan official who was described like what they were worried about in regards to him. This was back in 2000. Our only concern is that someone in his past might decide to go public. It's a pretty poignant moment when the you know archdiocese when the attorney Trahant, who's questioning Hecker, asks him like, so they're worried about someone going public, but they weren't worried about you possibly raping someone else, like they weren't, or you molesting someone else, like they're worried about you going public. And he basically concedes that it is. So it's remarkable. Took a long time to go through. It took a long time to go through. I think that you will understand everything a lot more if you take the time to read it. It's a lengthy report, but I think it's one of the most important pieces I've done, and I think David would agree it's one of the most important pieces he's done, and hoping that that people take the time to become familiar with it.
Well, we'll do our part. Okay. Well, Ramon, thank you for all you've done. I've told people this is really an important story. And I think it's more important than people realize. It's been picked up by a lot of newspapers, which is one thing, but if people start reading it and if people in power start making decisions based on this, it could be maybe the sort of thing that kind of shakes up the Catholic Church and there'll be some reforms, and that the things that are good about the church will survive. But it's really important for the story to get out. So congratulations on that.
Look, Errol, I appreciate it. I appreciate you. I know you've had me on a couple of times to talk about the stuff, and you've had me on Informed Sources a couple of times. It doesn't always get picked up locally, right? Some of the revelations that I've been able to collaborate with David Hammer on haven't always been picked up by the other outlets locally. So I appreciate you, helping us reach a broader audience by having us on.
But we'll keep up with it as long as you're willing to talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.